With a strange sort of tenderness, Miriam used a fresh rag to wipe away the gem's large, central facet. Then she clipped the inner doors closed, trapping the sapphire within, and replaced the small pin that would keep them secure. The sapphire gleamed within the locket. A blue so deep it reminded him of the austral sea, sailing and staring down into water so welcoming he yearned to dive in. He blinked, trying to clear the vision from his eyes, but he couldn't. He leapt from the edge of the ship and dove into the sea. The chill of the water embraced him, dragged him down, down, until he went rigid from it. He stared up at the sunlight spearing through the water. He stared below into the yawning darkness. "Come," it beckoned. "Your daughter awaits, as does your wife." He blinked once more and found himself staring into a different sort of darkness. He was on a blasted plain, standing on dark, glass-like rock. He'd returned to the desert, delivered here by Hamza Kir as an offering to one of Gojan's children.
"Ramad!"
The Arrak had come. It had devoured King Alduin here, in this very place. Later, Miriam had leaned over her father's dead form, touched her forehead to his.
"I'm sorry," she'd whispered. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry."
"Ramad!"
They'd left after Ramad had promised Chayda to the Arrak if they didn't deliver Hamza Kir. They'd headed into the desert, making their way toward Sharakai. They swam in an oasis pool, the water warm as bathwater.
"I've done a terrible thing, Ramad."
She'd fallen into his arms, sobbing. They'd held one another, made love beneath the stars.
"Ramad!"
He heard a metallic click and realized Miriam was snapping her fingers before his eyes. Slowly the vision of the desert faded.
"I've done a terrible thing."
And the room in the Chimeri Embassy house resolved from the fog. Left in its wake was a manic fear. Some small remnant of the Arrak's desperation, Ramad knew.
"Do you see now?"
Miriam said, gripping the locket so tightly her knuckles had turned white. The outer doors were closed, cutting off the power of the gem.
"Every step from this point forward must be taken with the greatest care."
"Of course." Ramad shook his head, though whether it was to emphasize his point or to clear his head, he wasn't sure.
"Of course you're right. Forgive me."
When Ramad had returned with the gem 2 weeks before, Rumayesh had been greatly weakened by Miriam's attack. She would return to power soon, if left untouched, but time surrounded by lead would be sufficient to render the Arrak all but powerless. They had both agreed to keep Rumayesh in the box for 2 weeks anyway, but mighty Alu, the sheer power in that creature.
"I never realized how easy it would be to fall into her trap." "Fear not. Her anger is lending her strength, but it will soon burn itself out. We've done well this day."
"And now?"
Amaryllis asked.
"Now?"
Miriam lifted the locket and let it swing before her eyes. "Now comes the first test of the Arrak's power." Chapter 35.
"Ride aboard her ship,"
Shalalara told Emre as Tribe Kadri prepared to sail for Onur's camp.
"What?"
Emre shot a look toward the Malasani dhow, where Hadad was seeing to her crew's preparations, while her hulk of a guardsman, Zakar, stood beside the main mast, still as stone.
"Why?"
"Yerinde's honeyed lips, Emre. You can't tell me you haven't seen her looks."
When Emre continued to stare, confused, Shalalara's knowing smile turned to one of surprise that bordered on outrage.
She can't take her eyes off you.
Emre tried to recover himself by remaining silent.
Can't take her eyes off me.
Men,
Shalalara said, and shoved him toward Hadad's Tao, Calamity's reign.
Go. Find out more about her king's plans.
It's something Masid will want to know, and if things have to happen between the sheets before she talks, she winked. I won't be the one to tell.
I wouldn't,
but Shalalara was already walking away. Emre felt the fool as Shalalara's biting laugh cut above the sounds of ships preparing to sail, and twice the fool as he turned and realized Hadad had seen the whole exchange. She turned away quickly, but gods curse him, he had seen her hiding a smile. He just hoped Shalalara hadn't been speaking loud enough for her to hear.
You look like you've been sentenced to hang,
Hadad called down from the deck when he drew near. He felt his face redden.
Yes, well, I wonder if there might be room for one more.
Hadad looked as if she were about to say something biting, but then her look softened and she shrugged.
Why not?
After a moment's pause, Emre headed up Calamity's gangplank. Hadad largely ignored him. The crew, however, sent him furtive looks, and Zakhar watched him like he wanted to draw his scimitar and see how far he could make Emre's head sail. Soon, they were headed east. Emre was standing amidships when Hadad broke away from her duties and joined him.
Is it true you saved Masid and the others?
Emre shrugged.
I had a hand in it.
She laughed loudly, head tilted back like a hyena.
More than a hand, if even half of what I've heard is true. Forgive me, but could you tell that stone-faced idiot to stop staring at me before I cut him a new smile?
Hadad turned, confused. Zakhar was still watching from his spot at the main mast, where he had been standing since Emre had first spotted him.
Ah, Zakhar does forget his manners at times.
Go below,
she told the big man. Zakhar obeyed, his footsteps thudded against the deck, and, by the gods, Emre felt it beneath his feet. When he was gone, Hadad said,
Better?
Better. Now what was it they were saying about me?
Your lord said that twice you sniffed out betrayal before it happened. Shalalara said you stole Masid's sword and shattered the chains across the harbor so you could all escape. Frelamai said you fought a dozen maidens before fleeing on one of the king's own ships to meet Masid in the desert and return his sword to him.
And now it was Emre's turn to laugh.
And you believe them?
Of course not. But the truth lies in there somewhere.
No?
Emre waggled his head.
Some small amount, I suppose. What of you? I've heard tell you saved your mad king from a terrible decision several years ago.
He said mad king to provoke, but Hadad merely raised one eyebrow.
Mad, is it?
As an old drunken goat.
She tilted her head, as if granting him the point, but with an expression that made it clear he'd sparked a painful memory.
The tale has grown in the telling.
You prevented a war, was how I heard it.
After her reaction, Emre was suddenly eager to talk about something other than the mad king of Malasan, but he pressed anyway. If the 13th tribe was to survive, they needed to know more about their neighbors. Apparently, Hadad's own caravan had delivered a shipment of dates to King Saradi's palace, and he had taken offense to the quality. He had gotten it into his head that the purveyor had meant it as an insult to Saradi himself. That very day, he'd summoned 1,000 of his best cavalry and ridden well into Sharakai's territory to the caravanserai of Ashtan Kut. Khadad, knowing well what Sharakai's response would be, should her king attack, had sailed back there herself and managed to talk Saradi down before blood was shed.
"Everyone in the east is sure the king will march once more," Emre continued. "All it will take is for him to stumble across a patch of sand to remind him that he still wants to conquer the great Shangazi."
"I'll share with you a secret, Emre Aikanava. Few yet know it, but the mad king of Malasan is dead. He passed only weeks ago. His son, Emir, now sits the throne in Samaril."
News indeed, Emre thought.
"How did he die?"
"Rumors are flying that Emir killed him, though if so, it wouldn't have been for his own sake. Saradi was in terrible pain these past many years. Killing him would have been a mercy. I think those rumors are just rumors, though. Emir would never have done that to his own father. I suspect it was his ill humors that finally took him."
"The dunes do shift," Emre said.
"Grinding bones until all has been forgotten. Isn't that what they say?"
"It is."
Emre watched as two crewmen began oiling the deck nearby.
"What now? Does King Emir covet the desert as his father once did?"
"How could he?" she asked with a wry smile. "In the desert no one can oppose the will of the Sharakani kings. All know this."
"Not the Malasani," Emre thought, "whose kings are nothing if not bold." The tribe sailed on, and days passed. Emre didn't always remain on Calamity's Reign, but he found himself sailing on it more often than he would have thought. He had been right about Hadad. She was a conniving woman, but after hearing her tales of navigating favor among the desert tribes and the auction blocks of caravanserais, he developed a grudging respect for her. One didn't become a caravan master without the ability to bargain shrewdly. That her king had turned that to his advantage was no real surprise. On their 12th day out from the meeting with Masid, Mihir's young cousin, Ariz, sent up their falcon, and this time it began circling in the distance. By evening they saw the masts of Unur's tribe on the horizon, and by sunset they were drawing near. They stopped well short of the large camp, which was gathered around a set of oases. A dozen small waterholes were revealed with trees and desert ferns huddled close around them. Beyond the pools, Onur's ships and tents were set in a defensive ring. All flew a pennant depicting Onur's new sign, a black spear over a field of amber. There were also other pennants flying on various ships and tents. The red design of tribe Masal were the most common, but there were a few sporting the river design of tribe Canaan, and even one showing the white tree of tribe Halarijan. From the black spear tents, a dozen warriors, men and women both, came to meet the Kadri ships. Mihir spoke with Onur's vizira, a hardened woman named Sibyl, and soon learned that Onur was not in camp.
"Where has he gone?" Mihir asked.
"He will return in a day, perhaps two. We have much to do before then in any case."
"I didn't ask when he would return," Mihir pressed. "I asked where he's gone." Sibyl sniffed and swept her gaze over the entire Kadri assemblage, as if the words she was about to speak were not only for Mihir, but for all of them.
"Onur goes where he will."
Now that tribe Masal had bowed to Onur's will, she said, their fleet was preparing to attack the nearby caravanserai of Tiazet, and much of the camp's activities were dedicated to it. The crews trained relentlessly, launching grapnels, firing ballistae, some practicing ship-to-ship raids, others drilled with spears and swords and shields, units moving in well-oiled concert. Tribe Cadre was expected to play its part. Sybil began by demanding that Mihir break his ships into three groups, that they might drill with others.
As soon as I speak to Onur. You're already speaking to him, Sybil replied easily. Until our lord returns, I am his voice. My ships are my own, Mihir replied, and they will drill together. Your ships are Onur's, and you will drill with those you'll fight beside.
Sybil paused, regarding Mihir as if she might a molding lemon that threatened to ruin the bushel.
Are you with us, Mihir Halimava of the Burning Hands, or are you not?
Emre hoped Mihir would say no, that he would leave and join hands with the 13th tribe, but he already knew Mihir wouldn't. He had committed himself, and there was little to be done until Onur returned.
Tribe Kadri is with you,
Mihir replied to Sybil. Emre nearly took out the knife Masid had given him. It was hidden inside his thorb. But Masid had been very clear that he should wait for the perfect time, when Mihir would be most open to it. If Sybil's tyrannical behavior was any indication of how the Burning Hands would be treated under Onur's rule, waiting would only help Emre's cause. The days that followed were strange. Tribe Kadri, her ships, and her people were ordered to remain well away from the center of the camp. Onur's tribe, Salmuk, was camped around the watering holes, which no one outside tribe Salmuk was allowed to visit. Water was always brought to the Kadri ships. Every night, screaming came from Onur's camp, making life more difficult.
Tribe Masal was taken by force,
Sybil told them when Mihir asked of it.
There were bound to be those who refused to recognize Onur as their sheikh. But do not worry. Those who resist are fewer each day, and soon we will sail united.
On their third night, Shalalara returned to Mihir's ship with a grim expression.
Beryl is dead,
she said when they were safely in the hold. Mihir's expressive eyes filled with worry.
How? Some knew she was blood of our blood. After Chedamin escaped, Onur suspected Beryl of treachery. One night, a few weeks before we arrived, she and nine others were bound and taken away. Taken where?
Emre asked.
No one knows. Shalalara turned to Mihir. But who can doubt they were given the knife? Or worse, given to Onur to feed his monstrous appetites? Someone must know the truth, Mihir said. Of course, but they'll never tell me, nor you, nor anyone from Tribe Kadri. I was likely to learn this much. Sybil saw me returning from their camp after I'd heard the news, gave me a look with those dead eyes of hers.
Shalalara was no wilting flower, and yet a violent shiver rattled up her frame.
She chills me to the bone, that one. She considers herself one of Onur's daughters, as they are being called now. Part Visira, part Sheikh, part Blade Maiden.
Emre couldn't take it any longer.
Will you not reconsider, Sheikh Mihir? The gods have shined upon you. You still have command of your people. Onur is missing. We might yet leave without suffering his wrath.
For a moment, Emre thought he had won him over. But Mihir hardened and refused to listen to reason.
Tribe Kadri does not run from conflict. I will speak with Onur.
When Emre made to speak again, Mihir spoke over him.
Do not press me. I've allowed you here as a favor to your lord, but I will brook no challenge to my commands.
On their fourth day at the oasis, Sybil came to their camp with a dozen warriors in her wake. They would make for Tiazet in the morning.
Not a single sail of Tribe Kadri will be hoisted before I've spoken with Sheikh Onur, Mihir protested.
He will speak to you after the battle,
Sybil replied and strode away. Mihir was left with an impossible choice. Shout at Sybil's retreating form and be seen as a man not worth listening to, or say nothing and be seen by his own tribe as weak. With grim determination he strode toward her, but stopped when the warriors flanking her drew the bows on their backs and knocked arrows. They hadn't drawn the strings, but they didn't need to.
None of my ships will sail for Tirzeth before I speak to Honor.
At this, Sybil turned. She was a tall woman, a grim woman. But at Mihir's words, a wide smile broke across her face.
Some say we all dig our own graves. There's truth in those words, I think. But I hope you won't dig yours so soon, Mihir. We need you, and if what your herald told us is true, you need us. Assuming, that is, you still wish to.
How did your emissary put it?
Drive a knife through the black heart of Sharakai?
Without waiting for a response, she left. Her warriors backed away, bows at the ready, and then turned to follow. Mihir looked ready to protest. But just then a horn sounded from the far side of the camp. In moments the entire mood of the camp changed. There was little enough joy to be found here, but now men, women, children, all became tight, their eyes nervous as they glanced eastward, where a skiff was now approaching.
It's now or never, Emery said to himself.
Approaching Mihir, he pulled out the kenshar Masid had given him and held it out, hilt first. Mihir stared down at the knife, confusion plain in his eyes. As he accepted the knife from Emre, however, his face lit in a mixture of wonder and confusion and surprise, even a bit of anger. Haddad, standing nearby, pointed at the knife.
What is this?
It is my brother's knife,
Mihir said breathlessly.
But how did you come by it? Masid tells me Anish was a good man, loyal to his last,
Emre replied.
He's dead.
Emre nodded and chose his next words carefully.
You've heard, no doubt, of the abduction of the Kalijah scholars over winter. It was a terrible blow to the kings, and after it, as a show of power, they gathered up many sacrificial lambs. Anish was one of those taken.
Haddad's eyes flitted between Emre and Mihir.
I don't understand. Anish left for Sharakai after my mother died.
Mihir pulled the kenshar from its sheath and examined the blade with a look Emre could only describe as reverent.
He refused to listen to my father, who urged us to live in peace with the kings of Sharakai. He took up with the Moonless Host in the city. I'd thought him dead many times. But news always came that he was still alive. He was chosen at random, Emre said, locked in a cage like an animal. His eyes put out, laurel leaves stuffed in his eyes and mouth. His hands were lashed to the bars of a cage to keep him propped up, as if begging for release. He was paraded through all of Sharakai, then brought to the southern harbour, where he and the others were hung from a tower, the leaves fluttering down like plucked feathers.
Emre pointed at the knife, allowing any sense of mercy to leach from his voice.
Anish did not die in battle. He did not die fighting the kings. He died because the kings wanted to make an example of him. He was as subject to their cruelties as you will be should you clasp hands with Anur.
Mihir's eyes were for the kenshar alone. Near the center of the camp, among the many ships anchored there, the skiff had stopped. A giant of a man was now climbing over the side. Honor. Emre had only seen him a few times before, and always from a distance. He'd never realized how massive the man was.
You see honor as an opportunity, Emre pressed on. I don't blame you, but it is a mirage. You cannot be blinded by his promises, nor can you listen to a Malasani king who sends his servant to the desert with sweet promises, even as she gathers information about you and the rest of the eastern tribes.
Hadad's eyes widened in anger, but Emre ignored her.
Join the Alaf Wakadar. Together we can settle an injustice that is centuries overdue.
My sheikh, Hadad said. What has the Moonless Host ever done for you? They took your brother. They failed to protect him when the kings came for him. And now, in recompense, they give you his Kensha? I may be new to the ways of the desert, but that seems a poor bargain to me. The kings are cruel, yes, but you reached out to Onur for a reason.
She waved dramatically behind her toward her ship.
Tell me it isn't so. Tell me you no longer wish to ally yourself with Onur, and I will board the Calamity now and sail for Malasan. But we both know you can use Onur. You can pit him against Sharakai, and the desert would be better for it.
Better for Malasan, you mean?
Emre said. Hadad shrugged.
Is it so wrong for us to want better men to deal with in Sharakai? We have no designs on the desert. We only want peace.
Emre laughed.
And you're willing to pay for it with the blood of Mihir's tribe? You'd rather we invade. Enough,
Mihir said.
He turned coolly to Emre and lifted the point of the knife to Emre's chin. Emre felt its bite, but he didn't shy from the pain.
Why would you have kept this from me until now?
Emre told him the truth.
Masid wanted you to have it before you spoke with Onur.
Mihir gripped the hair at the back of Emre's head and shook him roughly.
Why? So you would see him for what he truly is? He chose your brother, Sheikh Mihir. Dozens and dozens were gathered up by the silver spears, but Onur chose whose throats would be slit, whose mouths would be stuffed doll-like with leaves before being strapped inside cages and paraded about the city. He chose those who were hung from a tower like so many crows.
Emre thought Mihir would slit his throat and be done with it. Such was the anger in his eyes. But when he shoved Emre away and turned to look upon Onur, Emre knew he'd taken the bait. Hadad saw it too.
Mihir,
she began. He ignored her and strode forward. Backed by a dozen warriors from his tribe, Onur lumbered over the sand to meet him, Sibyl and the rest of Onur's retinue following. Onur came to a halt several paces away. Gods, the man was big. He towered over Mihir, staring down at him with a hungry sort of look. He lifted one hand and cracked a knuckle. In his other hand he gripped something. A stone, perhaps. It glinted and had a bright orange surface.
Well met,
Onur said in a deep, gravelly voice that sounded anything but pleased. Mihir lifted the knife.
This is the knife of my brother, Anish Halimava al-Qadri, a son of the Burning Hands. He was taken by the spears in Sharakai, and was paraded, naked, before the entire city.
Onur looked Mihir up and down in a way he hadn't when he had first arrived. He did not look beyond Mihir to the people of Tribe Qadri, but Emre had the sense he was now more than aware of them than he had been a moment ago.
What of it? You chose those who were slaughtered. Is this why you've brought your entire tribe? To ask me senseless questions? Did you choose them? Who told you this story?
Mihir gripped the knife so hard his arm shook.
Did you choose them?
Onur all but ignored Mihir as he looked to the warriors behind Mihir. He took in Hadad, Shall Alara and Emre. His gaze dropped until his eyes were lingering on Emre's hands. They had no orange tattoos, as Tribe Kadri did. He took in Shal Alara's hands as well, then lifted his gaze and sneered at Mihir.
Would you expect anything different? Would you not punish those who killed the children of your tribe? Anish was not part of the attack on the Collegia. Even so...
Mihir took a step forward, still gripping the knife, as if it were his last link to sanity.
You've not answered my question.
Onur spat on the sand between them.
I not only chose them, I chose the example to be made as well. Sharakai needed to learn what it means to test the might of the kings. It is a lesson they still need. A lesson I'll administer when I sit the throne, the one throne of Sharakai. I stood before those my spears had gathered up, the scum of the West End, the dross from the Forgotten Harbor. I selected each. I selected the method of their death. I selected the route they would take through the city. I even killed a few myself. Perhaps your brother was one of them.
For a moment, all were silence. Eyes shifted between Bahir and Onur. Mihir swallowed, the muscles along his neck taut, the shade from the sun casting them in stark relief. And then he was flying over the sand toward Onur. Chapter 36. Chaedah crouched low within the blooming fields, 3 leagues north of Sharakai. Concealed by the thorny branches of the Adhikara trees, she was little more than a darker patch of black beneath the shade of the twisted trees. The dunes rolled southward before her, under the heat of a relentless sun. Over those dunes, a horse and rider approached. For a long while, the wavering heat concealed all details, but as the rider came steadily nearer, she resolved into a blade maiden, riding a tall Akala, with a brass coat and fetlocks the colour of wrought iron. Chaedah recognised Melisse. 7 days had passed since Bet Iman and Chaedah's escape from the House of Kings. Dadzada thought this meeting a fool's errand, but Chaedah would not be swayed. He didn't know Melisse as Chaedah did. She was loyal to the kings, but her heart tired of the conflict. She wanted a way out of the endless war. She said as much to Chaedah. If Melisse wouldn't accept the truth, no one would. Focusing on the trees around her, Chaedah flexed her right hand. Pain came with the movement, and with it, a rapidly expanding awareness of the Adhikara and the creatures that slept among their roots.
Come, brothers and sisters.
Many of the Asirim were too deep in slumber to heed her call. Others were awake, but savage as wounded animals. She felt pity for them, but had no use for them here. She needed a soul who could share her story. So she flexed her hand again and reached farther, searching carefully for one that was aware, that understood the Asirim's plight. The wind picked up, making the thorny branches rattle. To her right, a black snake with bright yellow stripes slid away and was lost to the deeper shadows.
Come, she called, calming her mind. Today could change all our lives.
Still, there were none, and Melisse was riding closer. She considered taking an Adhikara petal, but quickly rejected the idea. Patience was needed here, not force or desperation. At last, she felt a child, a huddled, angry soul. Children were rare among the Asirim, and Chaedah had never spoken with one. So she took care as she reached for the girl.
Will you tell me your tale?
She seemed fearful, perhaps, of Chaedah, perhaps of Melisse, but something like grudging assent came from her.
Then gather your courage
and listen as I speak with this woman. No woman, the child corrected. A blade maiden. A woman. Like me.
When Melisse was several hundred yards from where Chaida hid, she pulled on her reins and slipped down to the sand. She walked lazily, shading her eyes, peering into the Adhikara as she went. Chaida waited, watching the horizon closely for signs of other maidens or silver spears. Coming to a stop, some distance from Chaida, Melisse whistled the maiden's call for, "Attend me." Ignoring her for the moment, Chaida crept along a path in the blooming fields to its outer edge, where she scanned the horizon for signs of anyone hoping to catch her unawares. This was a tricky gamble. The very nature of the blooming fields, which were set in a great ring around the city, meant she couldn't watch every angle of approach. But she'd chosen a time near enough to nightfall that if she sensed anything amiss, she could hide in the groves until the sun had set and then make her escape in her skiff, which was hidden a half league deeper into the desert. Dard Sada had wanted to join her here. In fact, after a terrible quarrel, he'd insisted on it, which was precisely why she'd left a note and slipped away in the dark of the night. She had made a vow to Melisse that she would come alone. Everything depended on her believing she could trust Chaida. Seeing nothing amiss beyond the grove, she returned to the inner ring, stepped out from the shelter of the twisted trees, and headed over the stony ground toward Melisse. Melisse turned and walked toward her, her horse plodding behind.
"That's far enough,"
Chaida said when she was 10 paces away. Melisse came to a halt and dropped the reins. Countless nicks could be seen in the leather of her maiden's dress. She wore her turban, but the veil hung down along her front, revealing her broad, freckled face. She betrayed no emotion as she scanned the Adhikara behind Chaida.
"I'm alone," Chaida said.
Melisse ignored her, continuing to peer through the trees until she was satisfied. Then she looked Chaida up and down.
"They're turning the city upside down trying to find you."
"I know. You've done me no favors. I'll be killed if the kings learn of this meeting."
"I know." "Then know this as well, Chedmin Ayaneshala. I've come not for you. I've come because you claim you know a way for us to move beyond the constant bloodshed."
"Melisse, I..." Chaida began.
She had practiced this speech 100 times, yet no matter how she arranged the words, they always sounded leaden and unconvincing. There was nothing for it now, though.
"The Asirim are not holy warriors as the kings would have you believe. They are the remains of the 13th tribe, sacrificed for the kings. Bet Iman was a tragedy, an event that took my people," she waved toward the Adhikara, "and turned them into slaves."
"You admitted then that you are part of the Moonless Host?"
"No. I am a member of the 13th tribe."
"There is no such thing as the 13th tribe, only a band of fanatics hoping to overthrow the kings."
"No, the tribe is real. Many would proudly declare themselves scarabs, but many others only want peace and to have their birthright restored."
Melisse seemed to compose herself.
"Chaida, I know the West End tells such stories to their children. The 13th tribe is at best a fanciful tale to justify bloodthirsty acts. At worst, it's a cynical lie they use to fill their ranks."
"No, it's the kings who have been lying. They've hidden what they've done from the beginning."
Melisse's face had turned to one of sufferance, as if she was saddened by Chaida's naivete.
"If what you're saying is true, why has it only now come to light? Why wouldn't the truth have been handed down for generations?"
"Because the kings suppressed it. They won the war, Melisse. They had the power of the gods behind them.
Because their cause was just.
Because the gods are cruel and bloodthirsty.
If you're only here to repeat the Moonless Host's propaganda...
It isn't propaganda, Melis. It's true. The Lost Tribe lives.
Cheder!
No!
Cheder clasped her hands before her and shook them. Please listen to me. I can prove it. I've felt the truth from the Asirim themselves. I've felt their stories through our bond.
Melis frowned. What do you mean?
They still yearn for the lives they once led. They still dream. They want freedom for their descendants, me and the rest of the 13th tribe.
I've been bonding with them for well over a decade, and I've felt no dreams. I've felt nothing save anger for the enemies of the kings.
Of course there's anger. But it's anger over their imprisonment, anger over what's happened to them.
Before Melis could say more, Cheder went on.
That's why I've asked you here. Let me show you, Melis. Let me share their dreams with you.
I've told you. I felt nothing from them.
Of course not. They're forbidden from sharing them with you, but not with me.
She walked forward until the two of them were near, then held her right hand out for Melis to take. When she didn't, Cheder took another step. Melis stood like stone, almost fearful of taking Cheder's hand.
This is blasphemy.
Don't you want to know the truth?
I know the truth.
But they both heard the uncertainty in her voice. Melis's gaze swept over the Adhikara, though it seemed to Cheder as if she was staring inwardly, searching for guidance. In the end, she steeled herself and gripped Cheder's hand. The moment she did, Cheder reached out to the Aesir she'd touched earlier and felt the same reticence as earlier.
All is well, Cheder said. Share your tale, and through me show the maidens what became of the 13th tribe.
Cheder felt the desert dissolve away until she was standing beside a girl with long curly hair. She stood upon a wall with thousands of others, soldiers, craftsmen, children, many wounded and bloodied, their eyes filled with worry. As one, they looked out over the desert, where hundreds of ships had gathered, where the might of the desert tribes was amassed for war. They stood, innumerable, the soldiers of the desert tribes, a veil of spears before the might of the city and its kings. The girl's terror was unbearable. She cried as she looked out over the gathered host, wondering if today was the day they would take the city. Only last night they'd broken through the walls in two places. The valor of the city's guard had pushed them back, but all knew it wouldn't last much longer. They couldn't hope to stand against so many. The fear within the girl ebbed as Kiral, King of Kings, strode from the city's gates over the paved road beyond. He wore a shining helm, bright scale armor, and a white knee-length surcoat beneath. Five from his personal guard accompanied him. When they came to a stop, the front line of the host parted, and a man marched forward. Suad, the Scourge of Sharakai, the sheikh who had somehow united all 12 tribes. Unlike Kiral, Suad came alone, a bold statement.
Not one of us fears you.
Suad's host was utterly silent. The people of the city standing along the wall watched breathlessly as Kiral and Suad spoke. The sun shifted in the sky by the time Kiral broke away in anger and marched toward the city gates. Suad remained, watching Kiral and his guardsmen retreat, hands clasped behind his back as if eminently pleased. Only when the gates had boomed shut did the sheikh turn and stride back to the gathered host. Suad said something as the soldiers made way for him,
A great roar picked up around him, then spread, moving farther and farther along the line. The desert warriors thrust their spears skyward and ululated until the sound of it shook the foundations of the city. It continued for hours, ebbing at times, then returning in a rush. Only when the sun set did silence return, but that made it worse, as if the Lord of all things was preparing to break down the city gates himself, the gathered host ready to sweep in behind him. The scene faded. The girl now stood on a plateau high above the city. Sharikai lay below. Fires were sprinkled throughout the city. The roar of battle still echoed through the streets, sounding distant and dreamlike from the Mount of Toriat. She stood now, with many others from all 12 tribes. Only a short distance away, the kings were arrayed before 6 numinous figures. The gods themselves had come at the behest of the kings. Tulathan, her silver skin resplendent in the moonlight. Rhea, surveying all who had gathered. Mischievous Baki and Dua Thash and winsome Yurinde. And Gojan, his twin tails lashing as he stalked over the earth behind the other gods. Their very presence meant they believed in Sharikai. They would save it. Pride swelled inside the girl. To have been born here, to have lived in the city the gods themselves claimed as their own. It drove away the fear that had been building since the tribes had arrived. It made her wish there was a way she might help. The sounds of battle diminished, and then vanished altogether. The kings spoke with the gods for a long while. They granted the kings their wondrous gifts. Kiral, an immaculate sword. Sukru, a black whip. Mesut, a golden band with a beautiful stone of jet. Each came with a kiss from Tulathan herself. And then they called for volunteers. The girl's father went first, her brother next. She was not far behind. She followed in their footsteps, knowing she would be helping to save the city, knowing she and the rest would drive the gathered soldiers away from Sharikai and back into the desert, where they would be hounded for their offences. She went gladly, her heart singing, and when Gojan himself kissed her on the lips, and she felt the change coming over her, she rejoiced. She was changed. She became one with the desert, a holy warrior, a blade the kings themselves would wield until the final days of the world. She went from the mount, bounding down the slope with glee in her heart. Dozens, hundreds of others ran by her side, howling the pride that could not be kept within them. To the walls they went, then through the city gates like birds from a cage. Ahead, the desert soldiers stood, spears arrayed. She could already taste their fear. She could feel their growing knowledge that the tide had turned against them. There were many, but that would not save them. She bayed like a jackal as she leapt among the enemy. Then all around her was madness. Chader lay against the sand. She started, confused by the wall of soldiers marching toward her. A moment later she realized it was only the Adhikara trees, their branches slowly churning as they did on Bet Shair. It was so strange she hardly knew what to think. Not once had she seen them move in sunlight. She turned, the emptiness of the desert striking her. She had returned from the Aesir's vision, except... "It's wrong," she said. Melis, who was on her hands and knees a few paces away, lifted her head and regarded Chader with an angry look. "Not wrong. It was the truth, seen with your own eyes."
"No," Chader said, coming to a stand. "There's something wrong. That wasn't how it happened."
Melis stood as well.
"It was, Chader. It was exactly this way."
She drew her sword.
"The only question is whether you knew it."
Melissa's eyes looked over Chader's shoulder. Chader turned and saw warriors in black dresses walking through the gaps in the Adhikara. Sumer first, followed by Camille. Indris came last, walking with a noticeable limp. Chader was struggling to understand what had happened. Melisse had betrayed her. That much was clear. But the Aesir? How could she have remembered the story in that way? It wasn't right. It couldn't be right. A man followed the woman through the gap in the trees, and a knot formed in Chader's throat. King Husamatin, tall and imposing, wore a striped blue kefir and a golden eagle across his brow. A black abba, a sleeveless cloak, covered a white tunic and wide cloth belt. In his right hand he held his two-handed shamshir, Knight's Kiss. Like the maiden's shamshirs, the length of the blade was made from ebon steel, but it drew light in, making it look like a piece of the night sky hungry to devour the day. Chader heard Dadzada's words.
Folly! Folly! This was all folly!
They fanned out before her. Indris had several ragged scars across her lips and chin that marred her otherwise pretty face. Camille's face showed pockmarks from the acid the shamblers had sprayed over her in Ishmantep. As the maidens moved to circle behind Chader, cutting off any hope of escape, Husamitin came to a stop a few paces from her. His eyes were dark and forbidding, his posture ready for anything.
"Give me your sword," he said.
In reply, Chader drew River's daughter. The maidens all drew their ebon blades in response. Indris, standing to Chader's right, was the only one who advanced.
No!
Usamitin's voice boomed. Indris kept her eyes on Chader, but she lowered her sword and took a half step back. Chader thought of charging Husamitin now, hoping to take him down before the others could react, but she sensed he was hoping for it, so she remained rooted where she was. Husamitin feinted with his sword, testing her reactions. It buzzed in the dry desert air.
The gods as my witness. I thought you would cower in the desert, protected by your newfound allies. I said as much to the other kings, but Cahil had the right of it. He said that ere spring returned to the Shangazi, you would return to the city to spread your lies. However much a traitor you might be, I said you were wiser than that.
His sword swayed, thrumming low.
But here you are, to prove me wrong.
I came to show everyone the shame you brought upon yourself and the city when you agreed to sacrifice us.
Shut your fool mouth,
Indris said, advancing. But again Husamitin forestalled her and focused on Chader.
Your claims are sad echoes of the lies aped endlessly by the moonless host. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised, but I would have thought you, one who's seen the truth with her own eyes, would have changed your mind by now.
Chader could sense the Aesirim all around her. She'd never felt them like this. Muted, muffled somehow. Including the girl who had given Chader and Melisse such a powerful vision of the past.
You did it, Chader realized. You were the author of that girl's tale.
She turned to Melisse.
Don't you see? He forced that story on the Aesir so you would believe their lies.
What she saw, Husamitin said before Melisse could respond, was the cold, simple truth. A truth that all in the Moonless Host have willfully ignored for generations in their quest for power.
I tell you, Chader said to them all, I've seen their stories. I've felt them. The Aesir Indris beheaded, and Havar, the one who so enraged me that I attacked Indris in revenge.
Indris's face turned red, but she remained silent.
Kerim, who came with us to Ishmantep. Sahid Alaz, their king.
Chader turned to them all, even Indris praying they would hear her words. But to a woman they stared back with faces of stone, while Husamitin looked on with a chilling mix of satisfaction and joy, pleasure at yet another avenue of truth having crumbled.
One day the desert will see your shame, Jada said.
Husamitin advanced, Knight's kiss held at the ready.
There is much in my life to be ashamed of, Chedamin Ayaneshala, but not this.
Cheda met his first swing with River's daughter. She controlled her swings, controlled her breathing, controlled her heart. She had long since felt Husamitin's heartbeat, as well as the maiden's, but the moment she tried to use it against him, he sidestepped her. Again and again she tried, but he was like a silver scale slipping through water. He seemed content not to press that advantage against her, though. For aching minutes, the sound of their swordplay filled the air. They moved easily over the sand, the maidens retreating to give them space to fight, but always keeping themselves between Cheda and the Adhikara trees, cutting off any possible escape. She rained blow after blow on Husamitin's defences, but he blocked them all, moving with the power, speed and agility she had grown accustomed to seeing from him during morning prayers in the House of Maidens. Then he unleashed a blinding series of moves, each of which struck River's daughter harder. The last left him with an opening that he used to bring his blade flat against the side of her head. She remembered tilting sideways, her turban flying free. She remembered trying to right herself, her body refusing to comply. Then she struck the sand, and the desert went dark. Chapter 37 Cheda woke to darkness and the smell of mould. She lay on cold stone. Somewhere water dripped. It tapped like rainwater from a roof long after the storm had passed, her limbs numb and tingling. She rolled over and saw a dim circle of light, little more than a puff of stardust against the utter blackness. Along the floor was a thin line of similar light. A door, she realized, with light shining through a window and a gap below. She wanted to investigate, but oh, how her body ached, especially her head, which felt like a quarry stone being hammered to pieces. Blow after merciless blow. Husamitin. The desert. It all returned in a rush, along with the conviction that Melisse would never believe her. Nor Sumeya, nor Camille, nor any other maiden. All the tales the Asirim had shared with her would now be seen as lies. A short while later, Cheda felt more than heard a presence. She tried to reach out for a heartbeat, but the pain in her head spiked so badly that for a while she could do nothing but lie there and hold her head to keep it from bursting. When the pain had passed, she lifted her head and stared at the round window. There were two stripes of black where the bars would surely be. Was it darker than before? She couldn't tell.
Hello?
She called weakly. There was no reply, and soon she was sure she had been mistaken. More time passed, and then a clink sounded in the darkness. She heard a scuffing outside the cell door, and then a soft glow flooded the hallway outside coming from the left. A jingling of keys came nearer, as did heavy footsteps. The yellow light grew, then stabbed harshly through the window, keys clinked, the door swung open, and light came crashing into the room, bringing with it pain and an unwelcome image of molten glass being doused in water.
"Leave us," came a deep voice, Husamitin's.
The jailer's footsteps shuffled away. When Cheda cracked her eyes open, she saw Husamitin sitting on a bench along the far wall near the door. The lantern was near his feet. It seemed strange to her that the door remained open. Husamitin was staring at her as if she were an oddity, a new prisoner he hadn't realized was here. From somewhere inside his black khalat, he retrieved a flask.